If you are into Sasquatch stories, you are going to love this program. Real Science as the legend meets science. In a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, I'm going to introduce two guests to you this hour and for the rest of the program as well. And this is just an incredible series of work that these two individuals have done. John Bindernagel is a graduate of the Wildlife Management option at the University of Guelph in Canada with a master's degree, PhD from University of Wisconsin as well. He is a professional wildlife biologist with international experience with the United Nations in wildlife conservation, research, training in East Africa, Iran, Nepal, and the Caribbean, as well as Central America. His field research has included wildlife surveys of bald eagles, seabirds, moose, bears, and other North American mammals. He's presently carrying out field work on Sasquatch or Bigfoot, Dr. John Bindernagel. John, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Good. I'm fine, thanks, George. How are you?
Good to have you with us. Very well.
Thanks.
Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum is an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He is also an affiliate curator at the Idaho Museum of Natural History and affiliate curator of the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. Dr. Meldrum has been investigating the ways monkeys, apes, and human ancestors get around or move for nearly 15 years. Some of his research has focused on the way in which the human foot has adapted to the habit of walking on 2 feet. His research compares and contrasts the anatomy and function of diverse primate feet. He has written a fascinating book called Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. Hello, Jeffrey. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Glad to be
good,
with you.
Good, good. The book, Sasquatch, is it out yet?
It is. It was released on the 19th, this past Tuesday.
Excellent.
So it's on store bookshelves and various online distributors now.
Tell me a little bit, if you can, Jeffrey, and you, John, of your personal interest in the search for Sasquatch. We'll go with you first, John.
Sorry, that's for me?
Yeah.
John or Jeff?
John.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Well, I'm a wildlife biologist, as you mentioned, and this actually came up when I was an undergraduate way back in 1963 when I raised it in class at university and was essentially laughed at. You know, when I mentioned this was actually the Roe report of 1955 when a man in northern British Columbia reported a Sasquatch. It was written up in, I think it was Argosy magazine. Well, you know, one doesn't like to be laughed at, and I thought, you know, I was pretty young and idealistic and thought we should be at least discussing this, but we weren't going to discuss it. That was not allowed. And that was my introduction to the whole idea that this is kind of a taboo subject amongst wildlife biologists and other zoologists. And that was the start right there.
How about you, Jeffrey?
Well, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest and obviously was exposed to some of the stories and events surrounding the early history of Bigfoot as it was known in the United States, but it wasn't until just a little over 10 years ago that it was sort of thrust upon me when I was confronted with a set of fresh footprints that were really otherwise inexplicable. And one thing led to another, and given my research interests in hominid evolution, and particularly the evolution of the locomotor system, an examination, evaluation of these unusual footprints was, you could say, right up my alley. And one thing has just led to another.
Jeffrey, tell me why the investigation and the research into, you know, the feet of the primate is so important. This is fascinating.
Well, obviously, we point to the habit of standing on two legs, of walking bipedally, as a uniquely human adaptation, and the business end of that behavior takes place at the feet, The feet are the part of the anatomy that most intimately interacts with the substrate that we're moving over, the ground, the soil, whatever the terrain might present. And so from that vantage point alone, the prospect of another large primate exhibiting a similar adaptation is really a fascinating natural experiment for an anthropologist such as myself to take a closer look at, because we could learn so much if we could study another species, as I believe, that has independently evolved this behavior under different similar circumstances, but in different biogeographical setting from the African hominids that are our ancestors. That comparison and contrast could really be enlightening in regarding the evolution of our own behavior and anatomy.
John, what is your reaction to the many reports we get of Bigfoot or Sasquatch sightings in the United States?
Well, my reaction is that here we have a large mammal that is, seen just like bears are seen, deer are seen, elk are seen, and which in fact is seen relatively commonly, because as we both know, most sightings do not become reports. So for every report that we receive, we know there could be a dozen, maybe 100 sightings that are not reported. So I've come to the conclusion that this animal, yes, it's rare, it's uncommon, but not as rare as we think, that there are more than we think, and that they're seen more commonly than we think.
Why haven't we obtained one? Why haven't we really been able to get, let's say, bones? They've got to die. Why can't we get bones of these creatures?
If that's for me, well, I mean, obviously, we'd have a different type of conversation if we did have that. And this is, in fact, what I've been working on these last couple of years. Why the resistance? You know, granted, okay, I guess my question is, in the absence of a carcass, can we not proceed? I think we have enough to proceed. We have very detailed eyewitness descriptions, rich, full descriptions going back, over 150 years. And now, and this is where Jeff's huge contribution is, he has an archived collection of plaster casts and these tracks, and he'll talk about more than I will, but I think they're so important because there's the corroboration. The tracks corroborate the existence of the Sasquatch. So I guess my point is that we really don't need a carcass. It would simply be more corroboration.
I would add to that, too, that type of a question or that concern and that when it's used as an objection to proceeding, why don't we have a body? Why isn't there a bone? Why aren't there fossils? Just simply reflects a bit of naivete about the natural history that is presumed for this species and the environment in which it reportedly lives. An animal that, if this indeed is a large ape, as I think both John and I tend to advocate, then we can extrapolate from their natural history a long life expectancy, a slow development to maturity, infrequent reproduction. And when you combine that, which equals essentially a death being an extremely rare event amongst a very rare and widely dispersed species, you combine that with the habitat in which they live, which notoriously produces very acidic soils that very quickly decompose and do away with any bone remains, then it's not really surprising that we don't have a bone or a body. You know, people are always amazed when I point out to them that we have virtually no fossil record, no direct fossil record of the ancestors of chimpanzees or gorillas. And it was quite a stunning revelation when just very recently, I think it was last year, the date escapes me now, when finally in Africa, not outside of Africa, but in Africa finally, four single isolated teeth or associated teeth were attributed directly to a chimpanzee ancestor. Now, that species has presumably been a resident of the African continent for at least 7 million years. And yet, for that 7 million years of residency, we have four teeth to show for it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I see where you're coming there. Yeah. You know, most of the reports of Sasquatch have come from people who have been out in the woods. They know what they're doing. They don't seem to be lying. Some of them may be, a group of policemen out with their friends on a camping trip. Could be dedicated campers, hunters, perhaps. But almost everyone, Jeffrey, reports some kind of intelligence behind these creatures, much more so than we would get from a primate, from a chimpanzee, or a gorilla. And are you getting that too? Do you hear things like that, that the intelligence level of this creature is a step above, maybe under a human being, but above these other primates?
Well, I do get that from witnesses or people who report encounters, but I think that impression of the eyewitness has to be tempered with the fact that we really don't have much opportunity as a population to interact with any primates on a regular basis. And people who have had the opportunity to interact as a caretaker or keeper or whatever with a higher primate, or have spent time simply gazing in wonder at a chimpanzee or a gorilla at a zoological garden, are also impressed and amazed that the level of interaction, the expression of intelligence is so much, qualitatively different than, say, their interaction with their pet dog or cat at home. And so I would have to temper those kinds of impressions, which are very subjective, because we don't see any of the types, any of the archaeological remains or other aspects that we would associate with a real higher intelligence, like tool use, like clothing, like control of fire, permanent home bases,
right,
complex social structure. I mean, unless we assume that this animal, with its higher intelligence, is so at one with nature that it has relinquished all need for a material culture. And that's a different question and kind of beyond the scope of what we can grapple with at this point of the study and investigation.
Some people, Jeffrey, have gone as far as to think that they could be extraterrestrial, they could be multidimensional. I assume you rule that out.
Well, my question to that would simply be, what is so intriguing to these advanced extraterrestrials about the wilderness areas of the Pacific Northwest, as opposed to downtown Manhattan?
Yeah.
I mean, if they were here to study humanity, why wouldn't they be popping up in population centers along the East Coast instead of their distribution just coincidentally coinciding with habitats of considerable precipitation in coniferous forests, primarily?
I agree with that. Dr. John, tell us, in your opinion, if you believe that these are more ape-like than human-like, exactly what do you think they look like?
Well, I'd like to make one comment on that last question, if I may.
Sure.
Extraterrestrial, because I think it's a very good question, and I know that's quite a common perception. And what I'm working at now in my second book is this business of scientific resistance, resistance by scientists to the subject. And what's happened is that although we know a great deal about the Sasquatch, there's been no real informed comment, so people have been free to form which some of us feel are, well, a little bit extreme interpretations, but people can't be faulted for that because of the absence of informed comment. And there's this kind of circularity going on here as we continue in sort of ignorance. I mean, in that, people like Jeff and I and many other investigators, have really acquired a pretty good understanding of Sasquatch food habits, behavior, but we can't get it out. Our papers are not accepted at scientific conferences, and so there's this problem. It's quite an ongoing problem. So I just wanted to comment on that. But yes, you asked about what they look like. We have, again, pretty good descriptions, and again, some of these descriptions go way back, and, basically, a large, hair-covered, human-shaped, gorilla-looking animal with some really strong ape-like characteristics, like the long arms, that flat nose with outward-facing nostrils, deep-set eyes, sometimes brow ridges.
A little more erect in how they stand.
Well, that's right. I mean, erect, you know, completely, you know, and again, here, my wildlife biologist colleagues keep insisting that people are misidentifying upright bears standing on their hind legs. And that's actually quite offensive to a hunter or a woodsman or a prospector who has seen a lot of bears and really is not amused when someone says that. But, you know, I've thought about this a great deal, and our problem here is that my colleagues and other zoologists are reluctant to look beyond, say, the North American Mammal Field Guide to explain a Sasquatch. So bears are the closest in the North American list, that's true, but if we would take a global list of mammals, there we would find gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, which are much, much closer to the Sasquatch. But this is an interesting thing, because that means, you know, adding North America to the list of continents occupied by great apes. And that, now that is a big leap, and I understand resistance from that point of view.
Okay, John, we can call you a scientist,
Thank you.
Most of your colleagues and most of Dr. Jeffrey's colleagues don't want anything to do with this subject. How does that make you feel?
Well, obviously it's frustrating. And this is, like I said, I'm working on this next book because, you know, having written one book describing the Sasquatch in detail, the anatomy, the behavior, the food habits, and having that book, you know, very well reviewed and acknowledged by some, you know, other scientists, you know, but essentially ignored, and that was 98, so it's been ignored for about 7 years. It's made me say, okay, what is the problem here? There definitely is a problem. Well, part of it is just what I was saying, and that's it's called parsimony. It's the, you know, scientists like a theory to be very simple, and you know there's two genuine problems with the Sasquatch. One is we've been talking about, it's bipedal. You know, we don't think of most great apes walking on 2 feet, even though they do from time to time. It's bipedal, and it's on the wrong continent. That's a big thing, being on the wrong continent. That does require, you know, an extension of ape distribution in the world. And there's a scientific concept called prematurity, and it's a discovery or a claim is premature if there aren't all the necessary links and steps leading up to it in general knowledge. Well, if we had another ape here, that would have helped, you know, and say, okay, this is just yet another ape, North American ape. But no, there are no apes here, as far as we know, and now we're claiming there is one. So that's one. But, you know, when you say, how does it make me feel? Well, it's very frustrating to have so much knowledge. You know, people have shared knowledge with Jeff and I and others, you know. And out of scientific responsibility, we try to share it with our scientific colleagues. It's kind of part of professional responsibility. But people I refer to as scientific gatekeepers, those people chairing conferences, no, we will not accept your paper on the Sasquatch. Yet all we're trying to do is share the evidence with them so that they might sort of get on the same page here and be working with it. So it's very frustrating to be blocked that way from moving ahead.
Well, at least you stand in there and fight it out. And Jeffrey, I got to believe you feel the same way.
Oh, absolutely. And if I could follow John and add one other thing about the great apes, what's interesting is most people, also again, and even colleagues of mine, I've noticed a decided bias in the attitudes of even some of my own colleagues. They forget that when we talk about living great apes, which is the chimpanzee, gorilla, and orangutan, we're talking about relic populations of apes on the verge of extinction inhabiting tropical refugia, where many species oftentimes sort of hold out as a last resort. And they forget ignore the fact that in prehistory, apes were extremely diverse and occupied a variety of habitats and locomotor adaptations and so forth, and spanned across the Eurasian continent, for which there is a reasonable but still very spotty fossil record. And so when we limit our comparisons to what is surviving today, then the Bigfoot sort of seems to be a little bit as the odd man out.
Yeah, that's true. Jeffrey, stay with us. Hold that thought. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Richard C. Hoagland's Joshua Free Conference, of course, Joshua Tree, but it's not free. It's 800-900-7030, 800-900-7030. Come on by or go to the enterprisemission.com website. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to spend a day and a half out there and study and learn as well. So come on by and meet me. We'll be back in a moment continuing this just incredible story and show with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum and Dr. John Bindernagel as we talk about Sasquatch right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going to get into some of the footprints, some of the work of Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. We're going to talk at their reaction to the Patterson film. I've got to tell you, this book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, incredible book, great work. And Dr. John Bindernagel's book is called North America's Great Ape, also the Sasquatch, both of them with just two, you know, almost textbook books on this subject, which you really don't get a lot of. Dr. Jeffrey, let's pick up where we left off. As we're talking about the frustration of, I guess, your colleagues in the belief system with Sasquatch.
Right. Well, and I'd have to say that the reaction truly spans the entire gambit of what you might expect. I have some colleagues who are extremely supportive and encouraging, and others that are diametrically opposed to it. And as you might expect, it's often an interesting correlation that those that are more receptive and open are those who have at least taken the time to consider the evidence on its own merits without any preconception or prejudice. And on the other hand, those who have the most dogmatic opinions directed against this subject are quite bluntly often the most ignorant of the nature of the evidence.
You know what, John, every once in a while when I open up our phone lines, we seem to always get a great Bigfoot or Sasquatch story from people. But every once in a while, we'll also get the story of the person who was with a friend who had a rifle, and they always take a shot at this creature, whatever it is. Why do people do this? Why can't they just wait? I mean, it's not like it is attacking them.
Oh, actually, that's very interesting because in my experience, people do not shoot at Sasquatches. People
really?
Yes, people you know, look at them through the scope on the rifle, and I've talked to two people who have had the crosshairs basically on the spine of its back and said, I couldn't pull the trigger on that. I mean, part of it is that, you know, most hunters are pretty responsible, and they don't want to shoot an animal that isn't the animal they're actually out there to shoot for meat or whatever. But also, you know, this very human-like appearance of it, and some people are just saying, well, I was afraid I'd be charged for manslaughter, or I simply ethically couldn't do it. But I have a couple reports of people who have accidentally shot Sasquatches. I mean, accidentally on purpose, in that one thought it was a wounded moose, and we're looking at it through the willows, and thought he had wounded the moose, went back and shot it, but when he walked up to it, he found a dead Sasquatch, and the other one, he thought it was a bear in the distance, and he shot it. But so I mean, these have happened, but in both cases, the people actually fled the carcass because they thought they'd done something wrong, which is kind of unfortunate because it's that carcass that we'd sort of like to have, no, even if it came in an unfortunate manner.
My interest in this subject stems when I was a kid and started reading about the abominable snowman up there in the Himalayas. Is this creature, the creature in the Himalayas, what has been called the abominable snowman, is that also what we're talking about here tonight?
If that's me, I think so. But I think it's interesting, you know, because, you know, our British and American colleagues are much more familiar with the Yeti situation. And an unfortunate thing happens because, you know, the Yeti is based on much, much less evidence than the North American Sasquatch. And I know one British writer has said, you know, these are travelers' tales and sun-enlarged footprints in the snow. Well, you know, the North American report are not just travelers' tales. These are the accurate descriptions of hunters and eyewitnesses like that. And we're talking about good, solid tracks in mud that have been cast and are sharp and clear sometimes, as Jeff will comment, you know, even showing like the prints, the dermal ridges, the dermatoglyphics. So there's quite a different thing, but there's that misconception. So the Yeti, in a way, has not helped the situation much here because people think, you know, well, Yeti's folklore, the Bigfoot is folklore, and yet he's not well documented. They think the Sasquatch isn't well documented when it is. And there's one more aspect, and that's the cultural anthropologists often try to explain the Sasquatch or the Yeti as the need of people to kind of invent a creature in their minds that bridges the gap between humans and other animals. And when they see this coming up in two different cultures, one in North America, one in Asia, they say, see, every culture has this need. Well, I mean, obviously this, whether or not we humans have that need, we're talking about something quite different here because it leaves tracks.
John, you have said in the past, you refer to the Sasquatch problem. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, this is what I'm sort of moving towards in my thinking these days. You know, as I mentioned in that last book, and then Jeff, I'm sure Jeff in his new book has done the same thing, really accurately describe the Sasquatch in detail, anatomically, behaviorally. We just know a lot about it. And so what is the problem? Why aren't universities out there studying it? Why aren't government agencies studying it? You know, well, the problem is this scientific resistance. And, you know, and then we have to start asking why the resistance. Yeah, well, we mentioned, you know, the justifiable reasons for resistance. You know, this is an ape on a different continent. Yeah, that's a bit of a leap. But there's also the problem of, you know, the hoaxes that have happened and the uncritical acceptance of the hoax claims. And also, you know, I mentioned the cultural anthropologist, the folklore sort of points of view, and people treat that as if it's mutually exclusive. It's either real or it's a myth, quite missing the point that, you know, most myths are rooted in fact. So this is quite a complex subject, but I think this is the problem, and it's the circularity and it's the lack of informed comment getting out there.
You know, what's fascinating, just last week, marine biologists revealed that they have found and studied, tens and tens of new creatures in the ocean, a shark that walks on its fins, creatures like that. It seems that we're trying to find out more about the ocean floor and the creatures in the ocean than we are on the surface. Jeffrey?
Well, again, it's always easy to accommodate the prospect of an unknown on the fringe, and that's one of the, I think, one of the sticking points that contributes to this problem, as John refers to it, is that I mean I've run into this with my own colleagues who say to me, I've been born and raised in the Northwest, I've hunted and fished all my life, if it was out there I would have seen it by now. Well, that's quite a grandiose claim, but that's the attitude that sort of lies at the heart of this, the notion that something like this could be literally in our own backyard instead of off in the frontier, in the fringe, and have remained unverified, unconfirmed. And again, it sort of feeds back to what I've described earlier, this naivete about the fact that, and it's especially prevalent in people who live on the East Coast or who live in Europe, this attitude that was so interestingly expressed by one particular British producer of a documentary who made the comment in print that everyone knows that there isn't one square inch of the Western United States that hasn't been trampled by hikers or backpackers or foresters. Well, I could drop him off in a few places and we'll see how long it takes for him to get trampled.
So true. Is there... You talked about the hoaxes, John. Mm-hmm. Is there a hoax out there, either one of you, that was so well known and so much of a hoax that you want to elaborate on? Was it a film? Was it a phony footprint? What might it have been?
Well, oh, gee.
Like the Patterson film, I guess.
Well, right. I guess the one that comes first to mind that I encountered when I was actually a youngster, was Ivan Marks's exploits with in the wake of the Bosberg incident, in which he cast a pall of doubt over that incident, in part because he attempted to exploit it by concocting a piece of video footage that created quite a circus atmosphere in the area and involved a number of notorieties in the Sasquatch or Bigfoot community of that time. And unfortunately, from my perspective, as I said, cast considerable doubt on the footprints associated with that location at that particular time, which are, from an anatomist's point of view, quite remarkable and stunning, and confirm some of the model of the Sasquatch foot that I've inferred from a number of independent examples that would lend considerable credibility to those what's been become known as the cripple foot set of footprints from Bosberg, Washington in the early 70s.
Have you heard of the reports of a Bigfoot capturing somebody and keeping him, I think it was like in a cave, and he finally escaped? Either one of you hear about that one?
Well, John could probably speak to that. I think you're referring to the Ostman story, which has become one of the so-called classics. And John, go ahead.
Yeah, there was that one when he was apparently abducted. He was in his sleeping bag and got picked up and carried off. And then there was one that they called a Jacko, and that's when the railway person actually captured a Sasquatch, and they kept it in a cage for some weeks in Yale, B.C., where it was observed by the townspeople. And that's an interesting one. It's back in the 1880s, I think, and it has a couple different endings, one of which says the people simply got bored with it and released it, and another ending has it being shipped off somewhere. But, you know, the problem is with these older ones, that can't be traced. You can only do so much with the historical stuff, and we're kind of left with it now. And that's the value in some of the more recent reports, living eyewitnesses, that you can actually follow up on these things. I wanted to mention on the hoax thing too, you know, we had quite a media frenzy in late 2002 when a road construction worker named Ray Wallace died, and his family came and showed the media wooden feet that he had constructed, and basically there was an interesting thing here that you know, the claim was, you know, my Uncle Ray or whoever, whatever they said, you know, made all these tracks, you know, and the media took that as explaining all Sasquatch tracks for all North America for virtually all time. And it was an incredibly detrimental piece of media, well, misrepresentation there. I mean, you know, we're still having tracks. The hoax is long dead. We're still having tracks, and there's all these remote places up in the BC coast where tracks are still found. But it's unfortunate because that happened at a time when I had a paper under consideration for a presentation at a biologist conference in Oregon, and the paper was rejected. You know, based on that media stuff, the people at the conference certainly didn't want this taboo subject, which had just, you know, in their view, just been proven to be a hoax, brought along. So it's actually, the hoaxes are kind of really quite important in a negative way.
Well, exactly. So much so that, in fact, the second chapter, I believe it is, in my book, specifically deals with the whole Wallace affair and the fiasco that was, and the poor showing by the media, the lack of discrimination and lack of rigor in reporting events accurately. And so that chapter attempts to set the record a little straighter anyway, and lay out the chain of events that led to that a case of extreme disinformation.
What about reports of small Sasquatches, like babies?
Well, I could speak to that in the terms that we have within the footprint cast collection here in my lab, examples as small as about 4.5 to 5 inches in length and on up, suggesting that might be the size at which they're first ambulatory or capable of walking on their own.
Did you say 4 to 5.5 inches?
Inches, right. And there are examples of pairs or even triplet sets of footprints, a female, presumably, with a rather gracile, you know, narrow foot, measuring 14 to 15 inches in length, and in company with those tracks, some small footprints. One incident that was described in some detail from the Blue Mountains of southeastern Washington was quite intriguing because of the associated behavior that could be inferred. The tracks were followed by the witnesses for quite some distance, and the smaller tracks would wander here and there and explore anthills and rotting stumps and then occasionally converge on the tracks of the adult, only to disappear, presumably being carried by the adult on her back or shoulders or whatever, and then a few hundred yards down the trail, when where the tracks could be followed, the small ones would then reappear again, as if they were ready to walk on their own and explore the environment a little further.
What kind of food do these creatures eat, John or Jeffrey, either one?
Yeah, I have actually a list in my book, about 20 items of vegetation and about 19 items of meat. And it's quite interesting because people expect the vegetation, the berries, the young leaves, the aquatic plants, and the occasional domestic fruit or vegetables. But the meat is interesting because, you know, people, once they kind of get the gorilla-like appearance, they assume a totally vegetative diet, you know, rather than a meat diet. But certainly on the coast here where we are, the coast of BC, and also from down Washington, Oregon, and up in Alaska, shellfish figures highly, and it also figures highly in the Aboriginal reports, and even the names for the Sasquatch, which is called Digs in the Sand, or it's called the Cockle-Eater, which sort of attest to the shellfish in the diet, but so a lot of it is foraging, like shellfish, and also digging up hibernating ground squirrels. But there's some pretty good descriptions of actual predation on deer. I don't know about elk. There's certainly stealing of meat and fish from game camps, but actual predation on deer, and Sasquatch is actually carrying ducks, so they've caught them somehow as well.
How about reports of these creatures trying to break into homes and things to get to food?
I've heard of this. I don't have anything specific, but I have heard of that happening, going actually into freezers and that sort of thing. Maybe Jeff knows.
Well, likewise, I've heard of that type of thing. A lot of cabins that will often have a freezer out on the front porch, and sometimes sightings involve an individual apparently ransacking such a freezer. I would add, too, to what John said, the interesting point that the fact that these reports do encompass the eating of meat is really very significant and bears on this, again, this question of what's a great ape doing in North America. Because for an ape to make a living in North America, you would expect it, you would predict that indeed it would be quite omnivorous, and that animal protein would almost certainly have to, although people are often unaware of the tremendous richness of the fruit and vegetative resources that are available in the temperate rainforests of North America. You would anticipate or expect that animal protein would have to play a significant role in their diet. And so the fact that this rather un-ape-like behavior, and especially back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, before we really knew how significant animal protein was in the diet of chimpanzees, for example, and their hunting behavior. This actually anticipated that primate or that great ape behavior. But you would really expect that here for a large omnivorous ape inhabiting the environment, the habitats of the Western North America, especially during the wintertime.
And they have to be eating well because they're pretty bulky, based on these reports.
Right, certainly.
How tall are they?
Well, estimates range considerably, but I would just suggest that a ballpark average for an adult female would be in the 6.5 to 7.5 foot range, and an adult male probably would top that by another foot and a half.
So these reports of large creatures are pretty accurate then?
I believe so, yeah, and they correlate well with the proportions of the footprints that are associated with the sightings.
Well, let's talk about the footprints when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.